Welcome to Top Shelf at the Merrick Library with your host, Carol Ann Tack.
Welcome to episode 44 of Top Shelf at Merrick Library. I'm your host, Carol Ann Tack, and thanks as always for joining me. Okay, think of the street that you live on. Think of around the block from you, the people there, and then extend yourself a little further and think of your neighborhood. Think of the people that you know in your town. And if I were to say to you, oh, that's a good family right there, or so-and-so comes from a good family, is there a family that jumps to your mind right away as I'm saying this to you? And then think about, how do you qualify a good family? Is it a happy marriage or great kids? Do they do acts of community service and volunteer? Do they have a big house? Is it money? All of these things signify something solid, right? Solid footing, reliable people, good people. You can rely in your mind on this family to be consistent with your idea of what a good family is or signifies. And as the host of Top Shelf for these many episodes, my Achilles heel, as most of you know, is that suburban family drama. Now think about the books and authors we've hosted here on Top Shelf, right? Paraboo's The Fall of Lisa Bello, Matthew Norman's Last Couple Standing, White Elephant by Julia Langsdorff, and In the Building, I've hosted Suzanne Byrne for Dogs of Littlefield, and The Wonder Garden by Lauren Acampora. All dark suburban dramas that reveal things that are not always what they seem, or they're at least they're not what we grant certain designations to, these certain assumptions that we make about these people. So these titles are very head-turning for me, and now I can gladly add another book to this group that I adore. I am gladly adding debut novel, A Good Family, by A.H. Kim to that list. And yes, you heard me correctly. The title is A Good Family. So book clubs, start your engines. I cannot tell you how excited I am to host A.H. Kim as today's guest for her terrific debut, A Good Family. A.H. Kim, thank you for joining me so much on episode 44 of Top Shelf at Merrick Library.
Thank you so much, Carol Ann, for having me on the show. I am so thrilled. And that list of authors that you just read, and I've been going through the archives and I've been like, what? Jean Kwok, Angie Kim? You know, it's like that movie thing where they say, I'm not worthy. I totally had a moment where like, oh, I can't even begin to compare to these folks, but I'm just delighted and honored to be here.
And everybody has to start somewhere. You are in this great group of people already, in my opinion. And once people start reading this book, they're going to think exactly the same thing. I just want to give some of the listeners a little bit of background about you, this wonderful, wonderful writer. Anne Kim, writing as A.H. Kim, was born in South Korea and immigrated to Ohio as a toddler. She was educated at Harvard College and Berkeley Law School, where she was an editor of the California Law Review. She is a practicing attorney and has served as chief of staff to the CEO and head of investor relations at a Fortune 200 company. She is the proud mother of two sons, a longtime cancer survivor, community volunteer, and a member of the Writer's Grotto. She and her husband live in San Francisco, and A Good Family is her first published novel. I don't know how to thank her for being here. I will not even do justice to this book with my description. So, Anne, if you wouldn't mind, please share with listeners, what is A Good Family?
So A Good Family is a domestic thriller, sort of in the vein of Big Little Lies. And what I call it is Big Little Lies meets Gone Girl with a twist of Orange is the New Black. So it's about a beautiful pharmaceutical executive named Beth Lindstrom, sort of the Swedish-American, gorgeous, sort of almost supermodel type woman. And she rises very quickly in the ranks of this pharmaceutical company. And then something happens and she has to plead guilty in a whistleblower lawsuit. And as a result, she takes the fall for the company and she goes to women's prison. And so while she's in women's prison, she asks her sister-in-law, her Korean-American husband's sister, who is a law librarian, I love librarians, to come visit her in prison. And during that visit, she leans forward and she says, I think somebody helped set me up and I need you to help me figure out who it is. And that's the plot of the book.
Okay, listeners, are you taking notes for that one? We hosted another debut author here on Tom Shelf. You mentioned it already, Angie Kim, the author of Miracle Creek. And that was an incredible interview. And one of the things Angie Kim said about A Good Family is this smart debut will keep readers turning the pages until its surprising conclusion. And then Maureen Corrigan of the Washington Post said, A Good Family is a lively suspense novel that provides the eternally welcome assurance that nobody has it all, at least not forever. Well, those are, first of all, Angie Kim hits it out of the park, and I read everything Maureen Corrigan writes. So
thank you for pulling out two of my favorite blurbs. Angie, she wrote Miracle Creek, and it was issued last year. And like a good lawyer or a good law librarian, I like to do my research. So I knew my book was coming out this year. And so I started to go to a lot of book events, in-person book events back in the day when we could go to in-person book events. And I met Angie, and her story is very similar to mine, born in Korea, immigrated here, had some struggles with assimilating and feeling bullied, all those things. And then she's a lawyer, went to Harvard. Anyway, she felt like she could be my twin or my sister. And so after the book reading with her, I made a beeline to her author signing table and I struck up a conversation with her. And it turns out she lives in Northern Virginia. My parents live in Northern Virginia. So I said, well, the next time I visit my parents, could I take you out for lunch? Because I would love to pick your brain about the debut author experience. And she was so gracious. We had lunch together. She gave me so many great tips about being a debut author. And then she wrote that lovely blurb for me. So Angie, I love. And then Maureen Corrigan, I will tell you, like she's the voice of Fresh Air Book Reviews. And so, which I've listened, like I love podcasts. So I've listened to that for years. And I like, she's got that way of enunciating her words that's so distinct. And so for me, like her voice is just the voice of the book reviewer. And so then when I found out that she had read and reviewed my book, I wouldn't have cared if she panned it. Just the fact that she even bothered to read it and review it was just amazing for me. And then she gave it a very solid review in the Washington Post. And it goes back to the thing that you said at the beginning of the session about what is a good family. And her point was, as soon as I saw that title, A Good Family, I knew it had to be ironic or it had to be a twist on that concept. So such great reviews and blurbers. So thank you for mentioning that. So the genesis of this was that I had actually written a YA novel, gosh, almost 8-9 years ago. And it was very heartfelt. It was very sweet. It was about a young Korean American girl growing up in a suburban environment and not fitting in and all those things. And I tried to get an agent for that book. And just didn't get anywhere with it. And I think part of it is that it really didn't have a plot. It didn't have any kind of way to describe it. It's this book meets that book. It was hard to market. And so after, I don't know, maybe 9 months, a year of trying to get an agent for that book, I sort of had that moment in the movie where the heroine gets her courage and her pep up. And she says, well, I'll show them. I'm going to become this huge success. And so I decided, well, I'll show them. I'm going to write a page turner, something that's very marketable, that's very commercial, that you can describe as this book is that book. And so then I had a moment of, okay, well, what's that book going to be? And at the time, I mean, this is the sad part of it. My sister-in-law, my brother's wife, had pled guilty in a legal case and she was going to prison. And it was around the same time that Orange is the New Black had come out on Netflix. And people were so fascinated by what's it like in prison? What kind of food do they eat? Do they sleep in cells? Do they get to go shopping? All those things. And because of my sister-in-law's experience, I had insight into all those experiences. And so I thought, I think I can take this sort of nub of a story and build it out into a page turner. And that's what turned into A Good Family.
So the inspiration for the novel, as you've mentioned, this real life circumstance, while you were processing this crisis with your brother, because it affects everybody in the family, were you writing about this in a therapeutic way, maybe journaling or doing something that then sparked the seeds for the book?
I would say yes. When my sister-in-law went into prison, one of the things I did was I started a blog where she could blog about her experience. My brother could blog about his experience. I could blog about my experience. And it was a private blog. It wasn't open to the public. But that was part of the way that I was able to learn you know, what it was like in prison, because she wrote me letters saying, today I went to the commissary to go shopping, or today I went to the CDR and this is what we had to eat. And some of that came from that. But I would say that more of the book came from this writing workshop that I took. It was meeting with a group of eight other writers and a facilitator once a week for about 8 or 9 weeks. And it was, I don't know if you've ever participated in a writing workshop, but you know, you open with like a prompt and then people write for 20 minutes and then you go around and you read your work. And so I was processing the experience and then doing this writing workshop at the same time. And some of the little pieces that I wrote in that workshop got a lot of positive reaction from my fellow writers. So for example, the opening scene of the book, where they're at their fancy family summer home and everyone's drunk and people are behaving badly. And the law librarian character, Hannah, is observing everything. She's the observer as well as the narrator. That was a piece that came out of that writing workshop. There's a speech that Sam, the brother, gives at a fire pit where he talks about how he came to be born as the younger brother of Hannah. And that also was a piece that I wrote during that workshop. So writing in community with other people, I can't recommend it more highly.
I've heard that from other authors. Just to go back briefly to Maureen Corrigan's review, she says, again, I want to repeat this, there's a welcome assurance that nobody has it all, at least not forever. And that is like a whoa moment for me, because what does that say about us? It's a moral dilemma. It's an ethical dilemma. But the book also shows that what you think you know about people is probably not what's really happening. And on top of that, you don't know the motivation of these people, especially the ones you're making the assumptions about. And you flip that over for the reader and bring that out. It's hard for me to imagine how you keep track of all the storylines and the motivations, but it really, you play right into what I love about these suburban dramas is what's going on in that house. And I do want to get into the first chapter of the book, because then the reader knows they're not even on their sofa in their living room anymore. And you really play to that feeling that people have of assuming what they think they know. You do it really beautifully.
Oh, thank you. Well, it does also go back to the concept of the good family, right? Your lead up was so perfect. So when you think of a good family, what do you think? Well, it sometimes depends on the context of a sentence. When you say he comes from a good family, at least in the olden days, that meant they come from a family with breeding. You know, they came here on the Mayflower, or they have a lot of money. They belong to the right country clubs. I think in a more generic sense, a good family, yeah, is a family that is intact, that they're not divorced, that maybe the parents volunteer in the community, go to church, whatever the community itself thinks is good. Or a good family are, despite the fact that they may be split up, a good family could be people who support one another, people who are there for one another through thick and thin, through illness, things like that. So there's so many different ways to define a good family. And at first, this blended family looks like a good family. They have cute children. They go to good schools. They all have nice clothes and nice homes. And then as you start to pick away a layer, it feels like it's not such a good family. There's infidelity. There's lying. There's cheating. And then, spoiler alert, by the end, I think you come to realize, oh, these bad people aren't so bad after all. They have very deep motivations that compelled them to do what they did.
Which humanizes them in a way that you don't normally think of, at least for me. I sort of glorify these people, and then you get down to the bare bones of their humanity. And one of the things the reader will notice right off the bat is the opening scene of the book, which you mentioned earlier, the family party, right? The reader kind of laughs and goes along and says, you know, I recognize the family reunion, or it could be a family party, a barbecue, you know, the ones that we used to have.
Right.
But then the honesty sets in about what's really going on. And Hannah, our law librarian, but also the sister-in-law, says, you know, these family reunions aren't exactly relaxing. And I will not go any further into what happens in that scene, because holy cow, what comes next, you will not expect. I'm going totally off my script. How was it to write that chapter? Did you know that was going to be your opening chapter?
I did. I did know that was going to be my opening chapter. And I'm revealing something I've never told in another interview before. So that scene was actually sort of based on a real life experience. It's not my family. It was actually another family's family reunion. And because I wasn't part of the family, I didn't feel like I was part of the group. And so I did do a lot of observation, kind of like Hannah does. And I mean, all the drunkenness and bad behavior that was kind of made up. But the setting of the beautiful home and the beautiful people was a thing that I had actually experienced. And so I will say that the first draft of that chapter had a lot more descriptions of how beautiful the house was. And my editors was like, you know, you kind of got to cut to the chase. Like, people don't want to read like a 10-page description of how beautiful the house was. And one of the things about when you're trying to get an agent is oftentimes they want you to send the first chapter or the first 5 or 10 pages. And so you kind of really need to hook them. So that's why, spoiler alert, the end of the first chapter, there's a big, ooh, wow, surprise hook that makes you say, okay, now I got to go read what happens next.
And that is, that's exactly what happened to me. I mean, exactly. I was very all in on the descriptions of that beautiful retreat, the Flocati rug. Like, I was there for all of that. She's making the snow angels. I just thought it was so visual, so beautifully written. Tell readers about Hannah Min, because she's a law librarian and she has such a voice. She kind of feels a little bit like us, right? I feel like I could relate to her. I understood her. I see where she's coming from, and she has the most amazing, astute observations.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for saying that. So Hannah, in some ways, is a stand-in for me, although I like to say I hope I'm not that judgmental and that strict or rigid as Hannah is, but Hannah always does the right thing. Like a law librarian, she knows the rules, she follows the rules, she enforces the rules. And she's actually not an immigrant. She was born in the United States, but as a Korean American who doesn't look like the rest of white America, it touches upon my experience of always feeling like an outsider. I mean, I was born not in the country, so I am a bit of an outsider, but my sister was born in this country and she's still treated like an outsider, even though she was born here. And so I think when you feel like an outsider, you are constantly watching for social cues. You're constantly trying to figure out, how do I speak here? How do I dress here? How are other people who are in power or who are respected acting and speaking in this context? What clothes do I wear? There are so many little social cues that if you're accepted and you feel confident in yourself, you probably don't even think about. But when you're an immigrant or when you're an outsider and you're trying to fit in, you're constantly aware of that. And so that's part of her character, is that she's just watching everything and she's trying to figure out what the social cues are, what the situation is, so she can fit in and also so she can be in control of it. And that's the other thing that Hannah has, is that she has a strong need to be in control of situations.
Yes, she does. The other thing about this book is the sibling rivalry. And I think of the HBO show Succession.
Right. So it's funny that you should mention Succession too. You're so on top of everything. My gosh. because I actually haven't watched the show Succession, but my publishers, Graydon House, have said, you know, we should really try to market this to people who like Succession because it's really got the same themes. And so, yeah, so you've hit that one out of the ballpark. So yeah, sibling rivalry is definitely a theme, or sibling relationships, I would say, not just rivalry, between Beth, who's the beautiful, glamorous pharmaceutical executive, and her older sister, Eva. So Eva is a dermatologist and a mother also. And so in the family, Eva was the smart one, the smart sister growing up. In the family, Beth was the younger sister. She was the pretty one. And full disclosure, in my family, I'm the smart one and my younger sister is the pretty one. And I think what I said is that it's, I think on the part of the parents, just an effort to give the child something that they can feel proud about. But the flip side of that is that it paints them a little bit into a corner, and you can't be anything other than the smart one. So what does that mean? That I'm not pretty? Or then the pretty one feels like, what? So I'm dumb, right? And it's by trying to highlight something that's positive, I think sometimes people start to focus on what the negative implication of that. And so trust me, my sister and I do not have the rivalry that these sisters have. And yeah, we've both gotten over our monikers. But these two women kind of didn't. That designation sort of pulls them apart and creates a barrier between them.
And there's a scene at a high school football game that has stayed with me. The scene is between Beth and Eva. And I mean, Anne, what the heck? I was sitting in the bleachers watching it happen. It was so vivid for me. I forget what the roller lip gloss.
It's a Maybelline. It's a Maybelline. Yeah.
The way you reach back and grab that from that time period, when you write that scene, it feels so true.
Well, one of the things I love about writing, probably the thing I love the most about writing, is creating worlds. And so when you're in the middle of writing a book or writing a story, it's like, these are your friends. These are your frenemies. You've created a world that you can just immerse yourself in. And the best way for me to create worlds is to pull from actual sense experience. So I grew up in the 70s and 80s. So like, we drank those cans of Tab. I remember like that feeling of that metallic aluminum can and the sizzle of the carbonation as it came out, and that kind of bitter taste of the aspartame that was in the Tab. It's such a sense memory for me. So I was able to draw on that to write that scene. I had that Maybelline sticky strawberry lip gloss that so many girls had back in the day. So that was just, it was fun for me to remember that and to write about it. The fruit stripe gum that we used to chew. I mean, there's so many little, and a lot of it is, you know, maybe brand name checking, but that's how I remember things. I remember things by color and taste and smell and sound. And so I do love to write that into my pieces.
So we're right around the same time period when I grew up. So when you said that strawberry lip roller thing, I thought, oh my gosh, I know exactly what that is. And then the cans of Tab, I thought, oh, I know what that is too. So it put me firmly in the place you wanted me to be. And that was amazing.
And I think for folks of my generation, that's not just a sense memory, but it's actually sort of like it evokes a little bit of an emotional memory as well. But what's nice is that people who are younger, who have never experienced that lip balm or whatever, hopefully the descriptions are clear enough so that they can get a sense of it. And what's been the biggest surprise for me, because I thought of this more as like a woman's book, as a woman's fiction book, is how many men have read the book and have told me that they've enjoyed it. At first, when men would come to me and say, oh, I'm going to buy your book, I would wince and think, oh, I don't think you're going to like it. There's a lot of brand names or women's themes in it. But almost to a one, men have enjoyed it as much, if not more, than my women friends.
Well, look at Big Little Lies. That book, anybody can read that book. I don't feel like it's been pigeonholed. I don't pigeonhole this. I mean, I guess you could argue that it's women's fiction, but I think it's everyone's fiction. I would hand this to somebody looking for something different in a second. So I feel like it's got that kind of Succession feel, that Big Little Lies feel. I think it checks off all those boxes. I do want to talk about Beth Lindstrom, her pragmatic approach. I couldn't believe how quickly she adjusted to prison life, but she admits quite honestly, there's a line in this book where she says, this is Beth, she says, you'd be amazed at how much less stress you feel when you don't have to worry about taking care of two young children, holding down a full-time job, and fighting off creditors. Wow. That is an absolutely honest, warts and all statement.
Yeah. And I will say that that's drawn from real life. While my sister-in-law was in prison, it was, of course, it was awful. Yeah. I mean, she had to be separated from her family. There was so much shame and stigma associated with being in prison, all of those things. I mean, there's no price that you can pay for that. But at the same time, and I joke about it to my friends who are now struggling to homeschool their children, put three solids on the table, do their job, do the laundry, all those things. I mean, it's impossible, right?
And I did have that feeling of Orange is the New Black, because what Orange is the New Black had done was introduce women's prison. Alderson's nickname is Camp Cupcake.
Yeah. So if you drive into Alderson, it's in West Virginia, and you're driving through the mountains, and the mountains were just brilliant with color. It was gorgeous. There are two famous resorts nearby, the Greenbrier and the Homestead. And so the Greenbrier and the Homestead are classic resorts from like the 1800s, I believe. They look like the Biltmore or something. They're beautiful resorts with pools and golf courses. These are places that presidents would go to vacation. And so not far from this women's prison are these two very, very famous historic resorts. So when you're driving there, you're just like, wow, this is really nice. And then when you get to the campus itself, it does look like a women's college. I mean, the buildings are kind of this pale brown brick, the colonial style, and there's green lawns and there's pathways. And it's from the outside doesn't look like a prison at all. There are no visible armed guards, there are no towers or a barbed wire or anything. So it's very misleading to the eye.
And it is exactly as you have described in the book. I found myself sympathetic to Beth and Hannah. I had sympathy for both of them. What have readers said? I know that during these very challenging times right now for authors to get out and talk to readers. Have you heard any feedback about either Beth or Hannah?
Yes. One of the first pieces of feedback I got very, very early was, wow, it's hard to enjoy a book that has two unlikable narrators. And I was shocked. I was like, oh, you're hurting my feelings because, you know, I find both of them likable. But I think what they meant was that neither one of them is entirely good. Hannah is quite judgmental and she's very closed off. And Beth, for lack of a better word, is kind of a B, whatever.
Yes, right.
And but again, as you sort of go through the book, you start to understand that they have depth to them that's different than what you see initially. I've had people on both sides. So many people love Hannah because what's not to love about her? She's very maternal. She takes care of her nieces. She takes care of her brother. She takes care of Beth. I mean, she sends her books and letters and all sorts of things. She's very selfless and caring of others. But with that comes that controlling and judgmental side. I really loved writing the Beth character because I could write very straightforward, short sentences, snarky sort of humor and cynicism. She knows what she wants and she grabs it. And she's very different in style from me, like personally. And yet, I mean, part of it is I aspire to be as brave as her. I aspire to be as take charge as she is. So that was fun. And I do appreciate when readers say, well, at first I didn't like Beth, but by the end, I really came to warm to her because that's what my intention is.
Yeah. And I think when you look at Beth, you think, wow, really, she's got the eye of the tiger. She can handle herself in these boardrooms. Those are sort of admirable qualities. There's a line, a sentence in the book that says, in boys, envy can transform into ambition and even inspire greatness. But in girls, it almost always spirals into insecurity and petty jealousy. Man.
I mean, I hate to say that because I hate to draw such clear lines between men and women or boys and girls. And I'm hopeful that as society changes, that that will not be the case. But I mean, the reality is that women continue to be judged by their appearance. A woman who doesn't take care of herself cannot really advance that much in the corporate world. Whereas, you know, we've known those schlubby guys who somehow seem to manage to get ahead despite their schlubbiness. And I do feel like there's this ability for men to say, well, if he's going to get that, I'm going to beat him. I'm going to rise to that challenge. Whereas with women, or even when we're very successful, we're constantly comparing ourselves with other women and saying, well, I may be successful, but I don't have the husband and children that she has. Or I may be successful, but I don't go to the gym and have toned abs the way she has. I mean, we're always looking at that comparison part. And, you know, Facebook and Instagram doesn't make it any better because we're now only seeing the highlights of everybody else's lives, whereas we're living the reality of our own lives.
Again, these are these Beth observations and Hannah observations that you've put forth. And it's really, it's a stunner. And as we're talking about this, we have to remember that wrapped around this entire family drama, we have a full-on mystery. We know Beth is in jail. I'm not going to say too much more to the readers about that. But who was the whistleblower? Who has set her up? And all of these characters trying to figure that out. How much fun did you have with that?
So, of course, I knew from the very beginning who had set her up. So that wasn't a mystery for me. But I don't like books where they don't give you any clues at all. They just all of a sudden at the end, oh, by the way, it was the butler. Well, you didn't give us any clues, so that wasn't very fair. I'm okay with red herrings, But it can't be all red herrings. It can't be a series of lies, because then you don't trust the writer. So I wanted to drop enough clues along the way that you could start to see it. And I actually like it when readers say, I thought I had it sort of figured out about 2/3 in, but I wasn't sure. And I don't mind if people figure it out before the end. I hope people don't figure it out right away. I don't like it when it's just a complete, like, well, that came out of nowhere. So that was fun to kind of drop the little breadcrumbs of clues along the way.
And watch the readers like me pick it up. And is it this person? Is it that person? That's what made it so compelling, because a lot of times when an author will drop those breadcrumbs, if I'm enjoying the story so much, I will deliberately put my blinders on and not try to figure it out. I do like that element of surprise. So kudos, lady. You did that for me.
Thank you. Well, the other thing I do want to point out to people is that some people say, like, how did you keep track of all your lies? And what I say, and this is a spoiler, is there are no lies. There are red herrings. There are things that maybe don't lead to the answer. But I don't believe that I put any direct lies in there. For example, there's the line where they say Beth grew up privileged with her own cook and driver. And that is completely accurate. But you find a different meaning to it later.
Yeah, it's
and
great.
So like that, you read it one way when you first read it. And I encourage people to read the book twice. Because when you read it the second time, all of a sudden you're just like, oh, I get that now. I completely misread it the first time. And there are so many clues along the way that you see lead to the result that you didn't see it the first time because you weren't looking for it.
Right. And again, we're making these assumptions about these people, but until you get to know these people, this concept of the good family or the person who comes from the good family really, really just changes. I don't want to say really anything else. Your debut novel published during COVID times. How have you been touring? How has that been for you? Do you get to go on the Zooms? And also, I do want to know where readers can find you on social media, where they can maybe crash these Zoom parties if they can.
Yes, absolutely. So before the pandemic hit, I only had one thing planned, which was a physical launch event at a bookstore near where I lived. And I wasn't sure what to do beyond that. I didn't want to fly all over the country. This is not a huge, huge book with a lot of publicity behind it.
Yet.
And so I had to cancel that in-person event. But in a weird way, this pandemic has opened up opportunities for me because I was able to schedule a number of Zoom events across the country. And so, for example, my editor, who's based in Toronto, said to me, she hasn't gone to a lot of her author's launch events because she lives in Toronto and most of the events are in the United States. But she was able to attend mine because it was virtual. So I've had a number of virtual book events, and then people like you, podcasters, bloggers, social media influencers have reached out to the debut community to offer opportunities for promotion. So that's been really great. So I think I've probably gotten more promotion for my book during the pandemic than I would have if we had had fewer restrictions on our ability to move around. So that's been great. And so you can find me on ahkim.net. That's my website. And that has buy links to the book. It has social media links to my Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. I also have a blog that I keep irregularly, and it has links to my different events as well as a lot of the events have been recorded. So if you want to go back and see my event with Angie Kim, yes. You can go back and actually, I don't know if that one was recorded, but I have a number of events that have been recorded and you can just watch those.
It's interesting because you have a great website. I love it. And when I was tootling through it, I found you reading, I don't know if it's the whole of chapter one or just part of chapter one, but I must have played it 3 or 4 times. And my husband's like, what are you listening to? I'm like, no, you don't understand. This is the opening to this book that is just like blowing my mind. So, and I listened to it again just before we connected again, because I just wanted to have the tone, the way you read it. It's a great tone of voice because it's Hannah's voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is Hannah's voice.
It is, and I just loved it. I mean, really, the fangirling must stop, Carol Ann.
Well, this is a mutual fangirling club now, so you've got a fan for life.
before, I don't want to let you go, but I've kept you already so long. What can you tell us? Is there anything next? So the book is out. Do you have something else that you're working on?
I do have something else that I have finished. I have a draft of a manuscript for my book 2, and I am sort of in the process of getting the whole agent publisher package together.
Okay.
But it's a modern retelling of Sense and Sensibility, but it's out here in the Bay Area, and it involves a half Korean family.
We're all here for that, for sure. We are here for that. And hopefully when that book comes out, you'll come back and spend some more time with me. Is there anything you can tell the readers that you've read recently or a book you want to recommend?
So I wish I could show you this line of books that I've created. When I grew up and I used to go to the library every other week and get a pile of books, I used to go to the K section to see, is there anybody named Kim who wrote a book? Because Kim is by far the most common Korean last name. So, you know, I would look at that section and there never was. And so now I look at the Kim section and there's, of course, Angie Kim and Miracle Creek. There's this beautiful middle grade book called Stand Up Yumi Chung by Jessica Kim. And there's actually one of the pioneer books in terms of Korean authors was Eugenia Kim and the Calligrapher's Daughter. So I would recommend my Kim siblings in terms of books. Yeah.
We'll shout out to all the Kims out there. That's amazing. So we finished this podcast. And are you still working full time?
I am a practicing attorney. I have lots of stuff to keep me busy. So one of my favorite sayings is, if you want something done, ask someone busy. People say, well, oh my gosh, how do you do? How do you have this very demanding day job and also do your book promotion and all those things? And I just like, well, I just live by my calendar. I schedule everything out and I make sure that I live by my calendar. But at some point I maybe would like to retire and write full time. Right now, that's not in the cards for me.
That's okay. We're going to help you along on that process. At least Top Shelf listeners will help you along in that process.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
And I can't thank you enough for being here. I mean, Anne, this has been amazing. Thank you so much.
Well, your enthusiasm for the book has just made my month. I have to say, it's so wonderful. Thank you so much.
Okay, listeners. Thank you so much again. It's nice to be back with all of you. And just pay attention to episode 44's podcast page. Put all the links up there. Remember to follow Top Shelf at Merrick Library on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and wherever you find most podcasts. For the latest and the greatest at the Merrick Library, check out our website at merricklibrary.org. Special thanks, as always, to Merrick Library Director Dan Chusmere, Assistant Director Diane Bondi, and the Merrick Library Board of Directors for getting us off the ground and onto the airwaves. Until the next time, remember to keep us on your top shelf.